It worked. Good morning. It's good to see everyone here this morning. We begin today a survey of the book of Isaiah. If you still need a copy of the handbook by Brother Harkrider, there's a few more copies left in the foyer. And after class, there is a one sheet of paper, front and back, handout that if you would like a copy, it's on the table with those notes as well. Today, we're going to begin 26 class periods on the book of Isaiah. We hope you'll enjoy it. Dale and I have talked about this class since October and look forward to being with you in this survey of Isaiah. As we think about Isaiah, today's class is heavily going to be involved in looking at the history that led up to why Isaiah presented his thoughts to the people. It lays a foundation, if you will. Isaiah proclaimed the holiness of God, the benefits of a righteous life. Isaiah warned of God's judgment and justice and how he is opposed to evil. Isaiah presents many prophecies also about Christ and the salvation he'll offer man. To understand why his message is so important, we're going to look at the history that leads up to the time and involves the time in which Isaiah lived. We're going to talk today about the man, the message, the theme. In the next class, we go to chapter 1, verse 1. Isaiah has 66 chapters. That makes it one of the longest books in the Old Testament. Because of the book's length, Isaiah is called one of the major prophets, along with Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And that covers the five books that involve the major prophets, which include Lamentations. You know that we've studied the minor prophets in the past, and those works are much shorter in length. One of the reasons we're going to look at the history today that led up to the time of the prophets is that it's so fundamental to why the prophets spoke the message they presented. It's also interesting that Isaiah, when we look at the book itself, does not always move chronologically. In other words, from the first year of his ministry to the last year. We will see different points in time there, so we need to have some concept of what was going on. Isaiah prophesied for about 40 years from 740 to 700 B.C., perhaps even to 690. Isaiah was one of the four prophets who prophesied in the 8th century B.C. Amos and Hosea prophesied to the northern kingdom of Israel, while Isaiah and Micah prophesied to Judah. It was a time of political and moral crisis in the area. God's spokesman, Isaiah, warned the people of the sin of idolatry and rebellion against God. As we study the conditions of the day, the things that Isaiah condemned, I think the challenge for each of us is to say, so what? And the so what, and we're going to talk about this maybe more than once this morning, is apply the message of Isaiah to the moral circumstances and conditions of today. Let's remember that the prophet spoke primarily to the people of their own day. Isaiah saw the results of the people's apostasy from God and tried to turn the people back to God. Because the people wouldn't listen, he told the people another nation would be used by God to chasten them. There would be a remnant, though, and that from that remnant would come hope. While the kings who had ruled the people had failed to keep the people constant in their devotion to God, Isaiah offers a message of hope that says God will save those who will turn back to him. At the time Isaiah spoke, it was a time of turmoil. Egypt was declining as a major power. Assyria was on the rise. So let's see what the history looks like. The first verses of the book of Genesis say, in the beginning. From the creation in Genesis, we see the births, the lives, and the ages of many men. And from the time of Adam in the Garden of Eden, the book of Genesis tells us of the descendants of Adam, like Methuselah and Noah. And by the year 2000, we reached the time of Abraham. From 2000 to about 1500, we see Abraham's descendants move to Egypt. And there they lived until Moses was born and became the one who led them out of Egypt. All along, God's plan for man was gradually unfolding. In this rough timeline, you can see when some of the early books of the Old Testament are thought to have been written. The departure of the people from Israel marks the birth of a nation. As they travel, God gives Israel, in Leviticus 26, three divine assurances. First, he says, he will bless them if they are obedient. Secondly, he says, if they're unfaithful, there will be judgment, and severe judgment, including sickness, defeat by their enemies, drought, crop failure, animal attack, siege, plague, food rationing, cannibalism, destruction of sacred places, sanctuaries, and cities. God then says in verse 33 of Leviticus 26 that they'll be deported to foreign countries. In Leviticus 26, verse 40, God tells them if they will confess their sins and unfaithfulness, he'll remember the covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He'll be their God. What I'm saying is that God said in Leviticus, long before the major and minor prophets, that the people will be punished if they are unfaithful, and ultimately they'll be deported from the land of promise with only a remnant to ever live there again. Now, that's not the only time God's told them that there are consequences to sin. A review of the books of the Bible penned by Moses will show that God warned the people more than once about sin and about the consequences of not serving him faithfully. In going to Canaan, God forbids the Israelites from forming alliances and marriages and relationships with the people that lived in those settled agricultural areas of Canaan, where they had the seductive fertility rituals that were so destructive to what God's pure worship had been given to the people in the wilderness. In passages such as Deuteronomy, 18th chapter, verses 9 through 22, God tells the Israelites the people in the land where they will live are evil, and they should not learn their evil ways. About 1040 B.C., as time passed, the Israelites were not satisfied with being ruled by God through priests and judges, and God allowed the introduction of kings. Beginning in about 1040 B.C., Saul, David, and Solomon reigned as kings for periods of 30 to 40 years each, with Saul's kingship beginning about 1040, David's kingship about 1010, and Solomon becoming king about 970. David was a gifted warrior who fought on behalf of Saul and himself to protect the kingdom. Like David, his father, the reign of Solomon lasted 40 years. Unlike Solomon, he wasn't a warrior like David, or unlike his father David, Solomon wasn't a warrior. Instead, he was a gifted businessman and formed political and commercial agreements with Egypt and other places. He also took an Egyptian wife in 1 Kings, the 3rd chapter, verse 1. 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, verse 1 says, King Solomon loved many foreign women. In verse 3, he had 700 wives and princesses and 300 concubines. And then in verse 4, it says, his wives turned his heart away from other gods. His heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. Now, that's an example of what comes from not following God's instructions. When you put the love of the world and the things of the world, including family, ahead of your duty to God, you need to quickly reevaluate your priorities. Between Solomon's pursuit and use of wealth and his intermarriage with the women of the nations, which was in disobedience to God's instructions in Exodus 34, 11 through 16, and Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, first four verses, Solomon turned away from God and did evil in the sight of God. So we've gone from a time when the people were being instructed by God in pure worship in the wilderness to problems in the land of Canaan, to the time where the kings have arisen and they serve God with faithfulness, to now we have a point in time where, although things looked outwardly pretty good when Solomon died, the idolatry he introduced laid the foundation for the kingdom's fall. So Solomon's death coincided with the collapse of David's empire and was followed by the disruption of the United Kingdom. When Solomon died, 1 Kings 11:43 says his son Rehoboam became king in his father's place. And in the 12th chapter, verse 6, he consulted with elders who had served his father but did not listen to the older men of wisdom. Instead, 1 Kings 12:8 says he forsook the counsel of the elders, which they had given him, and consulted with young men who grew up with him and served him. As you read further, the elders recommended that he lighten the yoke that had been placed by Solomon on the people. His young friend said, make it tougher. In verse 11, Rehoboam says, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. As a result, what we have is the United Kingdom was destroyed. The people reacted to the harsh rule, and they divided. The 10 northern tribes led by Jeroboam rebelled and split away from Judah. After the division of the kingdom, Rehoboam's kingdom was called Judah and composed of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And then the southern tribes were called Judah. Northern tribes are Israel. Southern tribes led by Rehoboam were, let me say it. Northern tribes led by Jeroboam are called Israel. Southern tribes led by Rehoboam are called Judah. To understand this division further, 1 Kings 12 tells us Jeroboam became the leader of the 10 northern tribes of Israel. He was not faithful to God. He made decisions to assure that the divided kingdom remained divided. And as you look at it geographically, the northern tribes had the most area. In 1 Kings 12, 25 through 33, we read that where Jeroboam realized the people, if they continued to visit Jerusalem for religious purposes, might not like the divided kingdom. So he took steps to make sure that the old allegiances to the house of David were not revived. He wanted to make sure that he kept the separation. So he raised two sanctuaries in the north to the status of national shrines. He made golden calves. So the king consulted in verse 28 and made two golden calves. It is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods. He set one up in Bethel and one in Dan. And these two golden calves in Dan and Bethel were designed to rival the temple in Jerusalem. Even worse, he pretended that these were the place where God would dwell. He even appointed his own priest and instituted his own feast and sacrifices. In 1 Kings 12 to 22 and 2 Chronicles 10 and following, you'll see many references to the divided kingdoms and their sinfulness. the divided kingdoms arose, the morals of the people went down. In about 800 BC, as the years passed and the kingdom stayed divided, the evil of people reached the point where God determined to send prophets to the people. Over the next 400 years, many men would serve as prophets, and the people would face multiple crises from the Assyrians and the Babylonians, which led to a period of exile before the remnant would return to Israel. As we talk about the prophets, let's realize that God raised up the prophets in times of spiritual and moral repression and decay, placed His word in their mouths, and sent them to try to turn the people back to Him. In Deuteronomy, the 18th chapter, verse 18, he says, "I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you. I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him." Simply stated then, the prophets were God's spokesmen. And it was God's words that they were designed to provide to the people. The message of the prophets was designed to try to save the nation from its idolatry and wickedness. Failing that, the prophets announced that the nation would be destroyed. But the nation would not be totally destroyed. A remnant would be saved. Out of that remnant would come an influence that would spread over the earth and bring all nations to God, out of the house of David. One would rule a great kingdom. And this occurred with the birth of Jesus and the establishment of the kingdom. As you open the Parkrider book, the very first sheet of paper, on the back side of that first sheet of paper, the second paragraph is a great summary of the message of the prophets. If you read that second paragraph on the back of the first sheet of paper in your workbook a half dozen times over the next 13 weeks, or read it once a week every time for the next 13 weeks, you're going to have a great memory of what the message of the prophets was designed to accomplish. Prophets such as Elisha began to speak to each kingdom in efforts to try to turn the people back to God. As you can see from the chart, Obadiah, Joel, and Jonah are thought to be some of the earliest prophets who spoke God's message from about 850 to 750. Now, our study is going to be with Isaiah, and it's going to cover 40 and maybe 50 years of time, 740 to 700 and maybe another 10 years to 690. As you see in the chart, there were many prophets who spoke between 800 and 400 B.C. As we look more closely at Isaiah's time, during the time of Isaiah that he prophesied, there were four Assyrian kings: Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser V, Sargon II, and Sennacherib. And then when you look at these kings individually, Tiglath-Pileser began a policy of deportation. The upper classes of the population of both Syria and Israel were deported to the Assyrian Empire. The people were replaced by settlers from other parts of the Assyrian Empire and from Babylonia and North Arabia. The next king was Shalmaneser V, who continued the conquest of the northern tribes. Then Sargon II, under whose rule the northern kingdom collapsed in about 722 B.C., and the Assyrians besieged the people and took many captive, and Sennacherib was the Assyrian king who invaded Judah and besieged Jerusalem. And among the northern tribes of Israel, we've already mentioned Jeroboam was evil. He ruled the northern tribes when Isaiah was born, and during his rule, the people enjoyed peace and prosperity, but they were morally and religiously bankrupt. In Judah, we had a different situation. Uzziah ruled when Isaiah was born and led the people in prosperity. and Judah gained some power and wealth. For instance, there's a great deal of building, including walls and towers and fortifications that were used in the defense. And there was the development of a standing army, and trade and agriculture was promoted, and a seaport was built. And to keep the peace, he paid tribute to the Philistines. So power and wealth were a focus. The results of this period was a society that was doing really, really, really well. But they were focused on wealth. Religious apostasy, the worship of idols, were accompanied by political corruption, great social and moral decay, and the focus on materialism and religious formality came about. And with prosperity, who did the people forget? God. There was internal corruption, political, social, moral, religious. And from without, there was the threat of Assyria. Inside, the threat of moral corruption. Homer Haley once said, "You see that same parallel in our nation today. This is the thing that's going to make our study of Isaiah interesting and profitable. You're going to be able to better evaluate what to look for and to expect in the United States as a result of this, because God doesn't change. Principles don't change. However God dealt with nations back there, he's going to deal with them on the same basis and principle today." So here you have the threat from without of Assyria, and from within, a moral and political and religious decay. What do we see about America today? We have some ongoing threats, don't we? From without, we've got terrorists and dictators and others. And we have within moral, political, and religious problems. As sin weakened Judah back then, I suggest that sin has weakened our country today. We're not the country we were when some of us who are with gray hair were growing up in the 60s and 50s and 70s. Because how many things have changed? How much moral decay have we seen in the last 50 years? Each of us should look at Isaiah, look at God's attitude towards sin, and evaluate the condition of America today as we interpret the news. As we look at some of those national influences of the time, Uzziah was followed by Ahaz, who made molten images of the Baalim. He revived the worship of Moloch and even had his son serve as a burnt offering. He set up improper places for worship, and he offered improper sacrifices. What does God want us to offer today? Doesn't he want us to offer proper sacrifice, a contrite heart, full obedience? If we love him, who should we obey? God and his word. Uzziah was followed by Ahaz, and Ahaz was followed by Hezekiah. Hezekiah was probably the better one out of those that we'll see in this time frame. He tried to return the people to God. By opening and cleansing the temple in Jerusalem, he eliminated the idols and the places of idol worship. But he was one man in the midst of a time where Uzziah was focused on power and wealth, and it led to materialism and religious formality, followed by Ahaz, who introduced idolatry and improper sacrifices. Then you come to Hezekiah, who tried to turn things around, but he was followed by Manasseh, who in 2 Kings, the 23rd chapter, the 26th through 27th verse, we can see is very evil. He emphasized idolatry. He emphasized heathen worship. In total, four kings ruled between the period of 790 and 700 BC. and it's a period of external threat from Assyria, and it's a period of internal threat of corruption. As you can see from the chart, Isaiah was born under the rule of Uzziah and worked and prophesied under the rule of Ahaz, Hezekiah, and Manasseh. To read the Bible's record of these events we've discussed, you need to read 2 Kings, the 14th chapter, verse 1 and following, or 2 Chronicles 26 and following. You'd want to read Ezra and Nehemiah. While the book of 2 Kings provides some overlapping views of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, Chronicles tries to present a record of the descent of the house of David. As you can tell, as we've gone through the history, we've gone from a time when men served God. We got to the time of Abraham. We moved to the time of Moses, where the people were in Egypt. He led them out. He tried to keep the people devoted to God. God provided them instructions in the wilderness to avoid the sinful practices of the Canaanites in the land they were going to. For a while they listened, then they wanted kings. After the period of Solomon and his downfall, morally, the divided kingdoms arose. The northern kingdom was filled with evil very quickly. The southern kingdom held out longer. God sent, from 800 to 400 B.C., prophets whose message was designed to try to turn the people back to God. Failing that, the message said God would destroy them. There would be a remnant that remained, and out of that remnant would come a Savior. We're going to see God's message played out in the book of Isaiah. Before I talk about Isaiah the man, any thoughts? Isaiah the prophet was born when Uzziah was king of Judah, and Jeroboam was the king of Israel. He lived through the prosperous times of Uzziah and Jotham, where the nation was militarily strong. He experienced the decline under Ahaz with civil war and the alliance with Assyria and the terrible financial burdens of the people being allied with Syria, with Assyria. He prophesied through the up and down days of Hezekiah and learned from experience and revelation that trust in God, the Holy One of Israel, was what the people needed. He tried to turn the people back to God. Isaiah was, according to the first chapter, the first verse, the son of Amoz, and his name meant Yahweh is salvation. That is, the Lord is the source of salvation. And his name indicates that his mission was to point the people to the Lord, because what is the only source of salvation? It is the Lord. His work occurred in and around Jerusalem. Like you and me, Isaiah was a sinner and had his human limitations. He was capable of being afraid. He makes his own confession of sinfulness in Isaiah, the 6th chapter. He was married to a prophetess in Isaiah, the 8th chapter, verse 3. He had two sons who had symbolic names. I need Dale to pronounce them, but the first was Shear-Jashub in the 7th chapter, verse 3, which means a remnant shall return. The second son has the longest name to appear in the English Bible, Meir Shalal Hashbaz, 8th chapter, verse 1, which roughly translated means swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. Prior to his prophetic ministry, Isaiah served in the royal court as a recorder of history. He recorded the actions of King Uzziah from the beginning to the end, according to 2 Chronicles 26, verse 22. He was called to the prophetic ministry in the year that King Uzziah died. Scholars suggest that year to be 739 B.C. His ministry lasted 40 years during the reign of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, and perhaps his ministry extended into the reign of the wicked king Manasseh, which would lead on to about 690, perhaps, which I think is what Harkrider suggests. No one seems to be able to say for sure. And any dates I give you, I think on some of the slides I've already noted, they're the best estimates that I have. As we study Isaiah, we're going to see that this man had a strong character and a very deep, abiding faith in God. As we look at his work, we're going to see he was a man of courage and conviction. He presents God's message in a forceful manner. He could speak to all classes of people, whether they were the common folk of Judah or they were in the king's court or the king himself. There were the major prophets and the minor prophets. Major referring only to the length of the books they wrote, minor, shorter books. And he was a contemporary of Isaiah was a contemporary of Micah, and they both prophesied in Judah, while Hosea, Isaiah was a contemporary of Hosea, who prophesied to the northern kingdom, and of Micah, who prophesied in Judah. He was one writer called Isaiah a theologian, a reformer, a statesman, a historian, a poet, an orator, a prince, and a patriot. Another said that he was bold and earnest and unafraid, living under five kings, only one of whom was religious and God-fearing. He was uncompromising. He was no boot licker or back patter. He denounces in the strongest terms the injustice, oppression, covetousness, and sensuality of the people. He didn't try to curry favor with the people, but he could be tender, compassionate, deeply reverent, and spiritual. As we look at a very general outline of the book of Isaiah, the book can be divided into an Assyrian period and a Babylonian period. First 39 chapters deal with the Assyrian period. The last chapters from 40 to 66 are a Babylonian period that offers hope in the midst of some very difficult moments. As we look at the Assyrian period, in the first portion of the book, he speaks first to the people of Jerusalem and Judah. He then delivers 10 different oracles, or messages, if you will, to the nations. And you see there listed Babylon and Philistia and Moab, Syria, Egypt, Edom, Arabia, Judah, Phoenicia, Ethiopia, Assyria. In chapters 20, and that's chapters 13 through 23, so we're going to see very similar messages in 13 through 23. In 24 to 27, he provides a message that God will destroy the sinful and bring salvation to the righteous. In chapter 28 to 35, he talks about the folly of the human alliances they formed with Egypt, and then presents six woes for Judah's relationship with Egypt and Assyria. Then the next section, in 36 through 39, talks about some of Hezekiah's faithfulness and God's rescue of Jerusalem from Assyria. In the final section of the book, 40 to 66, the majesty of God is presented, the nature and mission of God's divine servant, and the glory of the redeemed Zion. Prophetic message about Christ is presented. The book is going to end by focusing on God's future judgments and the glory that God offers those who are faithful. In summary, there are 39 chapters that talk about the Old Testament conditions and 27 chapters that deal with the Messiah, salvation, and so on. There are some significant lessons that we can see in the book of Isaiah. His prophetic ministry is unique. It came at a time of significant importance to try to get the people to realize that salvation can only be obtained by relying upon God and not upon man. The practical lessons I would suggest include the omniscience of God, since God knows and sees beyond the realm of human knowledge. Isaiah exposes also the foolishness of idolatry. Isaiah teaches that sin is evil in the sight of God, but that man can repent in sincerity and God will forgive us. Genuine repentance involves a change of the heart and the mind and requires ceasing from evil. Isaiah forcefully teaches that God's righteousness triumphs over evil and that the only hope for mankind is Christ and the new covenant that Christ will institute. This was done 740 to 700 B.C., long before Christ was born. Doug has said more than once, how do you tell whether the message of a prophet is true? Does it come about? We see that what Isaiah prophesied did come about. To close this section of our class, let me simply ask you again, read the second paragraph on page 2 at the front of your book. It was written by Haley. It's a very appropriate summary of the book of Isaiah and the fellow prophets. And each class period before you come to class, if you can look through the study material, that will be very helpful as we look at the actual verses of the book of Isaiah in this next period of study. Thank you.